I, like most people, love sitting around my dining table at home to enjoy a meal with my family, with friends, with guests. But there's something different about the chair that I sit on. I was driving home one day. We were just given most of our furniture, and it's perfectly good. But I was driving home one day and saw on the curbside, someone chucking out a whole bunch of stuff, including a dining chair. And I saw it, and it's like wider and it's higher, and I was hoping comfier than the one that I have. And so chucked it in the car. I'm a bit of a sucker for a curbside score, even if it sits in my garage for a few years and then goes on my curb, right? But man, we've furnished most of our house from a curbside. And so there's this one chair that is reserved for me. And the kids know that it's reserved for Daddy. And so they've actually called it Daddy's throne chair because it is wider and it is higher and is a bit grander. And I don't mind the image, to be honest. I'm kind of sitting at the head of the table with my beautiful queen right there. And we separate the two princes by the more sensible princesses in between to kind of control things. I've got a chair that's reserved for me. And they know not to sit in Daddy's throne chair. Unless it's their birthday. It's the special treat to go and sit in this chair. God has a throne chair, which is reserved for God and God alone. And the essence of sin is for us to refuse to acknowledge his rightful place on that throne, to bump him off and to put ourselves on it, thank you very much, to determine what is right, what is wrong, what the purpose of our lives is, and so on. But there is actually one other man who is entitled to sit on the throne chair of God. And Matthew, in his gospel account, has been determined for us to see who that is. It's Jesus Christ, Jesus Messiah, Jesus God's anointed King. And he's determined to show us this because he keeps doing things that are reserved for God. If we've been reading from the start, we will have seen that Jesus has the authority to speak as God. He quotes the Ten Commandments, but he says, "But I tell you." His words have power to heal the sick and raise the dead and still the storm. Demonic powers buckle before him. And so as we come to this chapter, which, as Ben said, is a very familiar one, Matthew, the writer, has the same big point for us that we've been seeing over and over these last few weeks, and that is who Jesus is. God's King who rightfully sits on God's throne chair. The one to be acknowledged and to be worshipped and to be submitted to, the one to delight in, the one to give our lives to. That's the big point of a very familiar passage. But there is more that we can say about it, and I'm going to just zone in on that first miracle, the one that we had read. Let me take you through it under three headings to see what is very familiar for many of us, what God might have for us there. Firstly, it's that Jesus is a good and powerful host. He is a compassionate king. Do you remember, Matthew's put this account here intentionally. Do you remember what came just beforehand? He's told us about Herod having a birthday party, where he's throwing a party with rich food and it's a banquet, but it's a party of immorality, of murder actually, where John the Baptist is innocently murdered. The very next passage, we have another meal with another host who is a good king. The menu is much simpler. It's fish burgers. But this host is using his power not to serve his own interests as Herod did, but to serve the needs of the needy, to show compassion. And so we pick it up there, verse 13. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. Now, verse 21 is going to tell us that this crowd is 5,000 men plus women and children. So what? 15, 20,000 people have followed him. Jesus can't even catch a breath. He wants to go to a place, to a solitary place. Parents with young kids, you get this right. You can't even get a solitary moment in the toilet. It's like, vroom, 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 let me in. But what does Jesus do when he's seeking solitude and need arrives at his feet, he meets it. He meets it. Verse 14, when Jesus landed, he saw the large crowd. He had compassion on them and healed their sick. Verse 15, as the evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place. It's getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go into the villages and buy themselves some food." They've had enough of the masses of the crowds. They want Jesus to themselves. They want a bit of peace and quiet. Check out Jesus' reply, verse 16. "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." Now, I can't help but picturing Jesus say this with a smile on his face. "You meet the need of a football stadium. I wonder what they'll do with this," he must be thinking. Well, here's what they do with it. "We've only got 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish." Now, John's gospel, all 4 gospel accounts include this miracle. It's the only miracle to be in all of them. It's a significant one. And John includes the detail that there was this little boy who had 5 little loaves and 2 little fish. It's a boy who's brought along his lunchbox that his mum packed for him. They're like, this isn't even enough to feed 12 grown men, let alone thousands and thousands. Us feed them? Yeah, right, Jesus. Now, if you've been reading along, what are you supposed to yell out to the disciples at this point? Remember the healings. Not with physiotherapy and a bunch of treatment, with a word, with a touch. Remember that little girl that he raised from dead to life. Remember that storm that he told to shut up and it obeyed. Remember the demonic that fled at his name. Remember who is with you. The one who has the right to sit on God's throne chair. Verse 18, "Bring the little boy's lunch to me," essentially. "Bring the 5 loaves, the 2 fish to me." He takes the loaves, the fish. He gives thanks, he breaks the bread and gives them to the disciples to hand out. Verse 20, they all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was 5,000 plus men, women and children. Jesus is the guy you want to have with you when you go on a spontaneous hike, yeah? You're not prepared, Jesus is there to meet the need. What do we see here? We see that compared to Herod, Jesus is a good, compassionate host who uses his power for the good of others. He's doing this to meet real need, but also to show the disciples, look at who I am. Look at what I'm doing. Just as God had fed Israel 40 days in the wilderness, here I am feeding a multitude in the wilderness. Look at who is with you. And Matthew records this for us to see who Jesus is. The one that the disciples will come to recognize as the Son of God, who will worship him, who will give their lives to him, just as we do with countless numbers of Christians through the ages. We come to see this Jesus as the one to be worshipped. The powerful, good, compassionate host. But before moving on, let me touch on something that becomes a big problem for many people and possibly for you. It's the problem of miracles. We live in an incredibly skeptical time, don't we? What do we do with these accounts that are claiming to record history, not once upon a time, history? What do we do with this bread? What do we do with the walking on water and so on? Well, there's kind of been 3 main responses or approaches to miracles. The first one is to give natural explanations. This became particularly popular last century when liberal Christianity was on the rise. It was very embarrassed by the accounts of the Gospels to kind of put historical names and figures and things alongside miracles. And so they would seek to explain them with natural explanations, mechanisms, so that it would be digestible, acceptable to a kind of enlightened, rational community. And so some people will read this and go, actually, no, what's happening here is a miracle of sharing. Jesus didn't kind of bring bread out of thin air. There was some people had some bread, and when the disciples shared theirs, when the little boy shares his, the people who did have food started to give it to those who didn't, and there was enough to go around. It was actually a miracle of a changed attitude, not anything that Jesus did. Or, I particularly like this one, real scholars have put their names to this. No, what's going on here is that people just had a tiny amount of the 5 loaves and 2 fish and fed 20,000. What, like they took a lick, gave the slobbery bit of bread to the next guy, and they went, I'm satisfied. Seriously, that's a greater miracle to take a lick and be satisfied than it is for Jesus to actually multiply the food, right? Natural explanations mean tugging at a thread that eventually unravels the entire message of the New Testament. And you may as well throw it all out, which of course is what is more common amongst our day, the 21st century, where people reject the Bible, the New Testament, the miracles out of hand, as unenlightened, unscientific, unreliable, unbelievable, for the gullible, for the weak who need a crutch. Because what it claims to record as historical fact violates the laws of nature. It violates the laws of nature. But there is a big philosophical assumption smuggled in here that many people aren't aware of. For example, it's said that Jesus cannot have walked on water because that would violate the law of gravity. Now, the apple and science reminds you of Isaac Newton. According to Newton's law of gravitation, when I drop this apple, it will fall towards the center of the earth. It's going to hit the floor, it's going to bruise, and my kids aren't going to eat it, right? There's a bruise from 8:30. According to Newton's law, let's try it. It'll hit the floor unless I catch it. The law of gravity doesn't prevent someone from intervening and changing the outcome for the apple. The law of gravity predicts what will happen, provided there's no change in the conditions under which the experiment is conducted. And that's the critical point. There is a difference between saying, this is what we normally experience, and saying, this is what we must experience, and there can be no exceptions. To say that is to speak from the point of view of naturalism, which is a worldview, is a belief that the world is a closed system and every event has a cause and effect relationship that must be explained by natural mechanisms within that system. And so when you embrace naturalism as a starting point, you can't actually assess the evidence open-mindedly, because everything must fit into that grid of there being no possibility, no reality of anyone or anything or any power outside what can be observed in a lab. Miracles then actually threaten the very basis of reality for the naturalist. They're a very scary thing. This is not a neutral thing. This is a terrifying thing because of what, if they are true, it says about reality. Which is why Peter Hitchens, the brother of the late Christopher Hitchens, one of the more prominent atheists of our day, Peter, though, is a Christian. And when he was in Australia speaking at a festival called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, he was asked, what do you think is the most dangerous idea? And he said, the most dangerous idea in human history remains the belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and rose from the dead. That is the most dangerous idea you will ever encounter. Why? Because if it's true, it says something massive about reality. This world is not a closed system. There is a supernatural being. There is our God. There is a creator, which now means the life I live is the one that he has created and sustains. And he is the one that I'm to give an account of. No. We'll bump him off the throne. And for many, naturalism will sit there. This is why C.S. Lewis helpfully said, Christianity, if false, is of no importance. But if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing that it cannot be is moderately important. We are dealing with the biggest things possible. And so the third response to miracles, and the only one that will see you in the kingdom of God, is to acknowledge there is a creator and that he is in control. Another word used for miracles in the Gospels, particularly John, though you do find it in Matthew as well, is sign. Signs. The miracles are signs, which is helpful because it tells you they point beyond themselves. What do they point to? The Creator, who is there, who is real, and who has stepped into his creation as the man, Jesus Christ, who has authority over every realm, including the natural, the one who is worthy to sit on God's throne chair. Christians are not denying the laws of nature. We're not putting our heads in the sand. We're not denying the cause and effect pattern. Rather, it's because of these laws that we can actually see in the New Testament God doing something miraculous. In a sense, it's like the apple that would have hit the floor apart from his intervention. And yet, that's not enough just to say that God's intervening, because the Christian view of the world of reality of God is bigger. All the regularities of natural laws depend on God and his work. So that apart from his work, every atom at every moment would cease to exist, would collapse, everything would deteriorate into chaos. And so in one sense, Jesus turning five bits of loaves to satisfy the thousands is in one sense no more spectacular than the fact that when I drop this apple, we can predict what will happen because of God's providence, his upholding and sustaining of his universe. Christianity is not anti-science, but it will clash with claims that begin with the unscientific assumption that there cannot be any more to reality than what you will find in a science lab. Jesus points us to the supernatural creator who is there, who is in control, but more than that, who is good, who has come to meet need, who is compassionate, as we see him doing as the powerful host meeting the need in this miracle. Okay, that's the first point. Secondly, what else can we learn from this parable? It's that this host, this Jesus, can do a lot with a little. I look at the fridge and the pantry and I go, oh, what are we going for dinner? And then Bree kind of works a magic and feeds six people. Jesus, he takes that to a whole nother level. Think about the disciples for a minute. They looked at what they lacked. Jesus looked at what they had. The disciples focus on all the food they don't have and this massive need that they can't meet. And Jesus says, bring me the fish burgers. Bring me what you got. And multiplies it so that the many are blessed. What about us? We're all too often like the disciples, aren't we? I've been both convicted and encouraged, particularly by this thing this week. We tend to look at what we lack, whereas Jesus looks at what we have. He says, bring it. Remember who I am. Is it the Bible for you? Ah, Jesus, I don't know enough about the Bible to be able to share you with my friends, with my family. I'm scared of the tough questions. I don't know where to go. And Jesus would say, you know the gospel, don't you? Tell them of the God who so loved the world that he sent his one and only son. Let me, Jesus, bless the simple sharing and preaching of the gospel word. I don't know enough. I'm not confident enough to see people to come to faith. You can invite people, can't you? You can invite someone very simply to come and hear the gospel proclaimed, maybe questions answered. Some of you know firsthand the way that Jesus can multiply a simple invitation, because you've done that. Hey, come and check this Jesus thing out. And they have, and they've heard the gospel and been convicted, they've been saved into eternity. And we keep seeing this over and over again. They then go out and say, hey, come and check this thing out. I haven't got it all figured out, but I do have this figured out. A new Christian told me last week, if you ever see me down at the roundabout waving these signs saying, you need to come and check the Jesus thing out, bear with me. I love the quote that says, evangelism is just one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. Jesus can bless just an invitation. Come. What about our gifting? Oh, Jesus, I don't have any spectacular gifts that are going to be a blessing to anyone, let alone lots of people. But no gift is spectacular on its own. It's only the enabling work of Jesus that makes anything we bring and offer spiritually significant. Friends, this is the only thing that keeps me going in Christian ministry. On my own, I got nothing. All I've got today is hot air, except for the word of the gospel that Jesus says, trust me. Let me bless. What about, I can't talk very well. Can you work a spreadsheet? Jesus says, think about how you can bring about great good, or how I can bring about great good by organizing kingdom work. Can you say hello to someone? Like, warmly, genuinely. Just last week, someone told me that they came to church here a bunch of years ago and they were in a bit of a tricky place and weren't sure, but someone warmly welcomed them. Like, not just hello, though, that's part of it, but welcome. Like, I love you and want to welcome you and want to see how I can just love you. And this person said that was such a significant thing that kind of helped them come through and connect in, and now many years later are serving a whole bunch of people. That person who just gave the welcome would be so humbled to see how Jesus can multiply a simple, loving greeting. Our money. In our setting, our context, you hear we're $80,000 behind budget and you figure, okay, maybe I could stretch, come up with what I can, but man, what's that compared to such a big need? Is that going to make a difference? Well, in this instance, along with much of our ministry, it's addition and multiplication that goes on, right? For many of us, kind of the stretching and what we can give on its own, not that much. But it's the addition. It's that we are a family and a growing family, and together, that actually adds up. But here's where it gets multiplied. Because God takes our efforts, our gospel efforts, our time, energy, money, and he multiplies that blessing into eternity. We are seeing it over and over and over again with children, teens, adults coming to faith in Jesus. What else could you give to that would have such multiplying effect? On our own efforts, what we possess, some might kind of look bigger than others, but on their own, they're small, for sure. But that's the point. Jesus says, bring it to me and remember who I am and let me bless and multiply. Friends, we worship the King who can do a lot with a little. Thirdly, what do we learn from this parable? Well, that's that Jesus is the ultimate satisfying meal. There are details even in this account that suggest Matthew's asking us to look beyond just the immediate context and to see a bigger thing that's going on here. Details like 12 basketfuls and so on. In the immediate context, Jesus is meeting people's need, their hunger, and they're satisfied until breakfast, when they're hungry again. Presumably they sort it out on their own then. But this miracle, this sign, it points to who Jesus is, God's King, but it also points to what he has come to do. You see that? Have a look at verse 19 again. Pay attention to the doing words of Jesus. He directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples and the disciples gave them to the people. Flip over now to chapter 26. Come forward. Matthew's intending the recipients of his gospel to see the whole thing, to keep reading. Matthew 26, verse 17. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations for Passover?" He replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and tell him, 'The teacher says my appointed time is near. I'm going to celebrate Passover with my disciples at your house.'" So the disciples did as Jesus had directed and prepared the Passover. Here's Jesus again giving instructions about the preparation of a meal. Verse 26, while they were eating, Jesus took bread. When he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to the disciples. The same wording of chapter 14, taking bread, giving thanks, breaking it. Yet this time, he makes the symbolism of what's going here on in this meal explicit. Verse 27, then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Chapter 14 was an amazing miracle, but they got hungry the next morning. It shows us who Jesus is, but points forward to what he has come to do. And we see here, Jesus is again taking bread, taking a meal to say, "This is what I've come to do. I am the meal that will eternally satisfy." How does he satisfy? In 2 ways. Firstly, he satisfies the wrath of God. We've sung this already, shielding sinners by his blood. In the first instance, this meal, his body broken, and what that represents, his death, satisfies the justice of God in punishing sin. The wine... symbolizing his blood, which is poured out for a purpose. What is it? For the forgiveness of sins. On the cross, the Son of God, the King who sits in God's throne chair, is nailed to a cross and hangs under the judgment of God, takes the punishment on behalf of covenant breakers. Takes the curses of the covenant upon himself and satisfies entirely, fully, God's justice so that there might be no more punishment for the person who would look to Jesus and see him there for your sins. The greatest satisfaction of this meal, well, it's to satisfy the wrath of God, which is to bring about forgiveness, which brings me back into covenant relationship with God so that I might know God and be known by God and call upon him as Father. I was at our sister Susie's funeral through the week and again helped to reflect in a very vivid way that there is only one thing that I possess that will survive the grave. There is only one thing that I possess for all I have, only one thing, and it's my relationship with God. It is a covenant relationship that cannot be broken, not even by death. It's a covenant relationship that cannot be broken, even as I fail to live a life that is short, that is unworthy of this relationship with God. Friends, you can be satisfied that God is satisfied that Jesus' death covered it all. Do you come weighed down by your sin this morning? Feed on Jesus, this meal, who satisfies the justice of God, his punishment, and satisfies you with forgiveness and peace with God. Maybe you are here for the first time checking these things out, or you've been checking them out and you've not come to know this meal. What are you waiting for? God says, look to my son, trust in him. Anything you have ever done will do, covered as you trust in him. Secondly, this meal of Jesus, it satisfies our souls. We know, or we should know, that good food is what energizes our bodies. In order for our bodies to work, to function, to energize, it needs good food. What is going to energize your soul? What is going to keep you going? Well, the Bible tells us it's this. It's the promises of God. It's his promises. Let me tell you something very basic about promises. They're about the future, right? And if they are promises about a bright future, then the power of promises is that they can instill and bring about an energy, a hope in the present. And Christianity holds out a promise of a future that is brighter than you could imagine. And the powerful thing about that hope, about what lies in the future, is that it can satisfy even if things are dark and bleak today. And so it's Isaiah that we read, let's look at it again, who puts this future hope so beautifully. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, no matter your background, no matter your type, no matter what you've done. A banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. It's an amazing menu, but the focus isn't on the food. It isn't on the wine, it's on the company. Look at who this meal is with. It's with the Lord Almighty. And look at the condition. Look at the state of this new reality within which this meal exists. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people. What is that? The sheet that covers all nations. What is that? Death. He will swallow up death forever. Man, if you could go to a funeral once a week, wow. You'd probably live differently, wouldn't you? We don't need to. We've got it in the scriptures. Some of you with older friends might feel like you're doing that. But gee, if I went to a funeral every week, I'd go home and look at the hail damage on my car and the leak in my roof differently, wouldn't I? The thing that has broken into our world as the greatest enemy, death. We often talk about people dying of natural causes. There is nothing natural about death. It is at odds with God's desire for life. Sin has broken and fractured. Being at this funeral, I had my own sadness for loss, but then you see it multiplied with the people, with the loss. A day is coming when that great enemy will be swallowed up forever. The decisive blow has already been dealt in the cross, in the resurrection of Jesus. One day we will know it no more. He will remove, the sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. The Lord has promised. Notice that they're forward looking. He will prepare. He will destroy. He will swallow up. He will wipe away. He will remove people's disgrace. Jesus' victory over death tell you that these promises, in a sense, have been completed and fulfilled in him, and we await the final fulfillment in his coming. And so, friends, feed on these promises, on this promise of such a bright future that has the power to generate energy and hope no matter what's going on. Maybe you are in a place of unhappiness and hardship. Maybe you are wondering, where is God at the moment? Cling to this beautiful promise in Scripture that God keeps count of our sleeplessness, of our tossings, of our restlessness. He catches our tears in a bottle. It doesn't go unnoticed, your hardship, your tears. He is there with you. But more, they're not wasted either, because we cling to this promise, don't we, that we know that in all things, in all things. God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Friends, what promises God has given us. Why would we nibble on the edges of the junk food of our world when we can feast on the promises that would satisfy our soul? God has entered into our world in the person of Jesus. He has control over everything. He multiplied the bread to feed 5,000 plus, but he went to a death where the good that would come from that is multiplied into infinity, into eternity, because anyone and everyone may now come and be forgiven and know these promises and await the day when there will be a meal at the table with Jesus, when the Lord Almighty will take his seat on the throne chair and we will rejoice. It seems only fitting that we might share in a mini meal together now, that we might actually take communion together as we read Jesus giving to his disciples, where we might remember what it is we have in him. So if you're new, and if you haven't put your trust in Jesus, but you're going, yes, I want this, I need this, then you come and grab the bread and juice along with those who have already done this. We're all going to hold on to it. But if this is the first time that you are coming to put your trust in Jesus, reflect. Reflect on the fact that God has come to die a death in your place in his son Jesus. So that as you come to take this bread, it points you to that reality. As you drink this juice, it points you to what we have. That's what we're going to do. There's some tables around the place. Try and grab a few for some people around you. We'll keep the traffic down. There's some smaller bowls with some gluten-free. Let's grab that, hold on to that. Let's reflect on what we've heard, what we're about to do, and I'll lead us in a moment. Well, this is a mini meal, but it is a physical, tangible gift from Jesus to point us to remind us of the great spiritual feast that we have in him by faith. And so, as you hold this bread, as you feel it in your fingers, as real as it is going down the back of your throat, you know that Jesus' body was broken for you. And so we eat remembering that. Many people drink to forget, whereas we drink to remember that Jesus was the perfect substitute whose life was poured out for us. And as wet as the juice is down your throat, is as real as the covenant of forgiveness that was sealed with his blood. And so we drink remembering with thankful hearts. As we use the voices God has given us to give him thanks and praise and petition him to continue to meet our need. Let's do that.